Hey Jeff, so this week we interviewed Jamandria Harris.
Word.
Yeah, have you heard their music before?
I have heard their music before. I'm not totally sure how I came across it, but I believe they were playing a show in Portland and I couldn't go, but they're an ambient musician. And they put out an EP called Tabernacle, and like I said, I couldn't go to the actual show, but I streamed it and then it's all available on Bandcamp and I bought it, and I listened to it a lot. I really dug it while I was working. While I work on my own stuff, I often listen to ambient stuff, and I really liked their music.
And I just realized I probably didn't intro them that accurately because I think Jumandre is, would you say they're more of a poet than a musician? Or it seems pretty equally balanced?
Well, they just put out their first poetry book. That's a good question. Equally balanced, maybe. I mean.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite parts, and I guess I should say again, we're doing this intro after we did the interview, but one of my favorite parts of the interview was hearing them read their poetry. And it's not this way with every writer, but there's definitely some writers, when I hear them read it really like just grabs me and I want to get their book. Where is Jamandria's book available or published from?
It just came out from Magic Helicopter Press, which one of the head editors is Mike Young, former Portland resident Mike Young. He's a great person for small press writing in general. So Magic Helicopter Press.
All right. Well, without further ado, here's Jamandria. Welcome to the Steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like.
A good intonation?
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really. I don't really need to like prepare because I don't really know what you guys are gonna ask.
We don't really know either.
We're just gonna talk.
I just have this article that inspired. That is a part of like my process of writing my book. And I brought my book, so if I don't know if y'all wanted me to read something from it, I could.
You totally
and
could
I
do
brought a
that.
copy for each of you too.
Oh, really?
Oh
So
my
yeah, I
gosh.
saw a PDF.
Thank
So
you.
no, that's amazing. I mean,
Oh
I read it
wow.
on PDF.
This is beautiful.
So, but this isn't out yet.
Yeah, it's the galley copy.
Well, do you not? I mean, we don't.
No, I have like 40 galley
Oh,
copies of it,
I'm not giving this back.
They sent you. They sent you quite a
Like,
few.
if you want to give yours back and feel qualms.
Well, this looks great. Did you
Yeah.
have a lot of changes or?
No, I mean galley copies usually, unless the publisher is real bad, they're not things
They're
that you have
legit.
to return. Yeah, and I trust Mike and Mike. Mike Young is the person who runs Magic Helicopter, and they're like one of my really good friends, and I really love them so much for everything they've done. So I'll probably, rec I, if you ask me about Magic Helicopter, I'll talk a lot about how special Mike is and how awesome Mike Young
He's
is.
he when 'cause he lived here for a little bit. Is
Yeah,
that?
Mike was here for like a minute, and then they moved to New Mexico.
Yeah, 'cause he stayed with me at the beginning. I mean, I know him. I probably don't think as well as you, but I know him decently well.
For sure.
Great, great,
Yeah, I
great
love
human.
Mike. Mike, then you know, yeah, Mike's like. Good.
Did you meet him here?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you met him when he lived here for a bit.
Yeah, he I don't even remember he asked me to perform for him. He was like when he was curating a couple of things. Then I read for him. And then we just became like friends. And then I had wanted to make a book and then we just, were talking about it. And then I didn't even know Mike had a press.
Oh, really?
Because I kind of purposefully kind of do this, like about sort of sets of information with people. I let people tell me about what they do, as opposed to like I don't Google people. I don't even Google people I date, So like I just let people tell me what they do. So like, and then when Mike was like, "Oh yeah, let me like let's do this," and we, it happened, and I didn't realize, at the time that it would be able to be have my graphic art in it. But. Mike, that happened, so it's super cool.
I actually am really glad to hear you say that because it's something I've been wondering about whether it's better to prepare or not for interviews. Because I love just saying, like, walking in, like, I don't know anything about you. Tell me.
Yeah.
And it feels a little more free for me. It sounds like you have the same thing.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I think about a lot of stuff. I don't know. I think that having it's like an element of the police state to be able to like have a dossier on everybody.
It's like 1984.
Yeah, that's very much police. It's like police state logic. So why would I, if I want to meet someone, like meet them energetically, like as people in person, why would I do that?
Yeah.
Well, I should probably put some of these on, right?
I was just going to offer, do you want to have those on? And there's a little volume knob that you can control your personal levels.
And this isn't live either, so it's like...
Yeah, it's not live.
So yay, it's like fun. It can be like...
We can't. You can can't swear, though.
No swearing. No swearing for the podcast.
Because it's going to go on a radio station.
Yeah, and they don't let any cussing anymore at all?
It's the FCC.
Oh, yeah, they
it's
do
just
that.
A national law.
I thought
law.
They had gotten over that. Like, I thought they stopped. I've heard cussing on the radio. I feel like...
It's certain hours, I think like after 10. It's ridiculous. I don't understand it. Mm.
Yeah. I like this beer. I like certain beers. I am like the one thing that I picked up when I moved here is like I'm a beer person now.
Oh, really?
I did not drink beer in Texas. I was like only a liquor person. I would get angry if people brought beer to like parties I threw. I'd be like, what is this trash? I can't drink this. This is whatever. But I came here and I was just like, whoa, okay, I'm in Portland. Like, I will have the beer. And it actually tasted good.
But this is 13 years ago. You've been here for a minute.
Yeah, for a minute. Is it? Because I came here when my daughter was 5 months old.
Okay.
And she turns 12 this year.
Oh, damn.
So, actually, it's 12 years. Yeah. It's like, all right, it's about the same time.
I mean, so I moved here in 05. 18.
So yeah, you're around the same time.
But then I left. I went back and forth.
Oh, where did you go back and forth from?
I mean, I moved here in 05. I went to Portland State. Then I moved to Lincoln, Nebraska. Did more school. Then I moved back here in 2013. Was here for 3.5 years. Then I moved to Omaha, Nebraska. And then I moved back to Portland in August. And so I've been back and forth quite a bit over the last...
Do you know my friend Tori Reese? Tori Reese does Homeschool PDX. They went to Nebraska. They went to Lincoln. They went to school there for a bit, and then they're from here, and they've gone back and forth.
Tori Reese.
Yeah.
Do you know when they were there? It doesn't sound
not exactly. I don't think I know off the top of my head. She just has talked about, she's lived all over, but I was like surprised, but not surprised, because I've also known people who've gone to Lincoln and been there in Nebraska,
really?
And then come back out here. And I have a little horror of the Midwest. Like, I have a little horror of the Midwest.
I like the phrase in there. I have a little horror of the Midwest.
I think I was in New York this summer, and we were talking about regionality, basically, and like, oh, what parts of the country do you think are absolutely terrifying? And then I'm like, oh, it's so interesting that people think Texas is more terrifying than like Nebraska or South Dakota, because I feel like, well, Texas is like Brazil, where like Brazil is fabulous and also has scorpions in the cities that kill people, and it's also really iniquitous, but it's also a gorgeous place and also vibrant, but also dangerous, but also, and Texas is like that. It just has like a
well, it's huge, too.
It's
right?
huge. It's just like people don't understand how big Texas is. And so it's like a joke when you meet somebody else from Texas. It's like, oh, where are you from in Texas? And it's like Dallas. And it's like, ha ha. You know, but it's like, what part of Dallas? Oh, from the north part of the Metroplex, which the Metroplex is basically like half the size of the state of Oregon. Like the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is like massive. It takes like 3-4 hours to drive across it.
Are you being serious?
I am being serious. Like, to drive from one end, the farthest east end, to the farthest west end, or the farthest north, it takes, like, you know, up to 3-3.5 hours. With traffic, it's longer.
And then I couldn't deal with that.
It's, like, the city. It's the sprawl. And that transit has gotten better there. I went back there for Christmas, and it was just like, oh, wow, there's buses now? That's interesting. And the train goes all the way up to Denton and all the way back down into Dallas, which is in a car. That's like a 45-minute drive. So the train is, like, that's pretty epic. That means, like, people can come out to shows in Denton now that couldn't get out of the city because they didn't want to drive that far. And then people can go into the city to do things. So I would think it's kind of changing some of the landscape, but it's interesting because it's like, I feel like Dallas is not a place that can be actually like gentrified. It's just got like these other currents of like of racial, like, terrorism, basically, and then also, like, classism that kind of prevent the conditions for gentrification as we understand it, like, in coastal cities or in places like Portland, because the politics are not there, the aesthetics are not there, like, the way people construct their lives is not, like, conducive to, like, building, like, gentrified spaces, really. There's, like, there's, like, versions of it, but it's obvious, like, inside of a place like Dallas that it isn't, this is obviously not Portland, you know? This is obviously not Austin. And even Austin is Austin. I just think it's funny when people, like, are, like, trying, it's like they don't see this as a homogenization where, like, people make the comparisons between, like, Austin and Portland and Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And, like, people don't see that as much as an homogenization as McMansions, because it is, like, ontologically and aesthetically about, like, a sort of, like, oh, let's replicate these things that are unique to, like, a region, to a place, to a set, to, like, a urban, you know, situation, and try and, like, dissipate them and dilute them so right. that everyone can access them, when the way to make everyone have access is actually these systemic changes and not these aesthetic, like, reaches to try and bring this, like, anesthetized, like, urbanized, semi-urban, semi-cool culture to, like, people who are not in these cities.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a lot of verbiage written about that. So, I mean, I don't even, like, care about that anymore. I mean, we're living in the Anthropocene. Like, everything's collapsing. Like, who cares? You know?
How do you define that word?
Anthropocene, where yeah. it's, like, the humans, we're about to, you know, basically, it's like, civilization as we know it is not going to be the same in 10 years. And it's...
You think that?
I don't think that. I mean, it's like...
You know that?
I don't know it, but it seems to be, like, the general scientific consensus, and then the consensus of, like, lots of other people who have more pieces of paper and degrees than me and have thought this through. It's like, stuff is not gonna be like this. And I'm fine with that, because I'm okay with change. I think that the construction of history in these static ways is pretty boring, and that history has never been smooth, and there is no such thing as, like, a peaceful period. There was no peaceful period. There's just war elsewhere. So
Pax Romana wasn't a thing.
Yeah, that's not actually a thing, yeah, you know. Yeah.
No, I wouldn't disagree.
So,
yeah.
So like, that's, I mean, I don't like those kinds of, like, lies when looking at how human animals have, like, moved through reality.
Yeah, we're constantly fighting.
Yeah, constantly fighting, yeah. And also finding entire new ways to, like, be animals together and collaborate and make habitats of the natural world, or to fight it, whichever choices people make. That said, I have, like, a lot of, like, really specific to, like, this era, like, political orientations that I don't even get into or talk about. They just, like, come into my writing, and they come out, like, when I start to talk to people about things. I tend to, like, sit on the outside of a lot of stuff and just watch a lot, and then come with, like, a really heavy, like, intense opinion. that's kind of what happens. I don't like to argue with people. I don't like to I don't believe in convincing people. I don't believe in trying to prove anything. Like, I'm not here to prove anything ever. You believe what you need to believe. I can't move your energy. You have to make that choice, and then I can work with you. But fighting you or arguing with you, like, that kind of tussling, some people are good like that. Some people can move people's minds through tussling. I can't. I don't want to tussle. I'll just get mad, and then I just want you to be hurt. You know?
Hurt or heard?
Hurt. And okay. Heard so that you don't tussle anymore. But
I mean, I'm very much the same way, that I find once it starts to become an argument, it's both people, their emotions are riled up, and we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
And I immediately, once I feel that starting, I kind of back off, and I'm like, this isn't doing either of us any good.
Yeah, because I know that's, like, if I'm talking a certain way and it's getting like that, then I'm not listening and I'm not receiving. Yeah. So when somebody talks to me that way, I'm just like, oh, this is that. I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
but
not...
some people are rhetoricians. They can argue well, and, I mean, hopefully
yeah.
There are people who, I mean, there's not a lot of them, I don't think.
No, I mean, like, I did debate in high school.
Oh, you did?
So, yeah,
so
I did,
you have,
like,
a background in this.
Yeah, so okay. I understand, like, the whole, like, structure of rhetoric and all this stuff, and that's also why I'm just like, no, I don't do this.
Well, because high school was a while ago, right?
I mean, yeah, and I used to also do not the real a world. Lot of, like, I used to also, like, in university, and then just also and when I've been in environments where, like, political environments, radical environments, where you have panels and workshops, and like you're talking to people who supposedly were all radical here, we're all anarchists here, or whatever, and then having to have like the like intense erasure and friction and kind of like violence that is coded as not being violence because we're all anarchists here, or like aren't we all trying to move towards this similar sort of radical reality? And I'm just like, no, actually, I'm really about like the interstitial violences that people commit against one another, like interpersonally. Like I feel like a lot of oppression flows in the small things, the same way that mm-hmm. like, you know, intergenerational trauma comes through DNA and then makes all these wider waves. I feel that like I hate the term microaggressions, because all like interfacing, all energy exchange between people creates wider effects. So it, by definition, oppression begins with eye contact or no eye contact, or how you make mm-hmm. eye contact. It begins with how you physically take up space or don't take up space, or how you feel like you can or can't take up space. It begins with who you look at for more than 5 seconds, or who you become attracted to after that 5 seconds, or who you don't, or who you feel empathy for, who you want to care for, and then, you know, that just ripples out. This all happens like in
yeah,
seconds.
It's all subconscious
yeah,
in a lot of
and I think that is the key. Or like where it's not in like a key, it's like the level at which you have to start dealing with how messed up like things have become.
Right.
It's just like
at the most basic level.
Yeah, like at the cellular level, at the level of DNA. That's why when this is this great big unraveling, is not actually that it's not disturbing to me in this other way, because it's necessary, because it's like the DNA has to be reformatted. What the culture, what will iterate from that after this unraveling, it will be like a new being, a new world that I believe in quite firmly. Not like Brave New World or like any kind of like scary, like pseudo, like commune, like whatever,
utopian
like
type
utopian, not utopian, but just that it is new, that it will be different, that it can be, whatever vision that you want to put out there, dependent on the level of like DNA work you want to do on yourself and engage in with those around you, in power with and not power over, which is another thing that I kind of think a lot about, is like power flows and differentials, which is kind of like the root of for me, like all the issues we have is about power exchange, but not necessarily in the like eroticized like BDSM way, but like in the just subtle, again, like eye contact, not eye contact, how people interact in public and how that builds the way people interface in a workplace. Like there's mm-hmm. you know, power flows all over the place there, and a lot of that gets erased, and then we're told to like think about these things in these wider categories, in these solid categories, these things that aren't flows, these things that aren't at like these little discrete modalities of perception. And I think that's, you know, that's a part of how the things that are destroying, that are bringing about the change that is going to lead to a lot of like pain and destruction, it's about that distraction from like the mindfulness of being present and like aware in the everyday, like in every little thing. But not with neuroses, not with like fixativeness, but with the idea that like every small bit is important.
And seeing, and I can totally see, at least I think I'm seeing it, what you're saying is so many of the things we do, whether it's aggressive or kindness or the myriad ways that we can act towards each other, to refer to it as one small act, it's more like ripples, that if you're throwing a bunch of rocks in the pond, you see them all spreading out, they affect each other.
Yeah, like that's pretty much like how I do. I read a lot of... Christopher Wilkinson is a writer who has translated like a lot of like the ancient tantric texts, holy texts, which are not
tantra,
but do you pronounce it tantra like I'm saying tantra like tantra.
Okay,
but tantra, but and tantra. I'll explain like tantra because and I'm using the correct pronunciation of tantra, they're not like tantra.
Sure.
Because okay, people think tantra is like sexual and that this is sex, and like I'm not here to have this big argument with all like the tantric yoga community that is all about like that. Like I'm not here to like diss them and whatever they're doing. That's like super great, and like Kundalini yoga is awesome too, and that's all like, yeah, that's all great. But like tantra is about energy, and it's about oneness. Right. So yeah, obviously that's going to include sex, but that isn't what it is about. And in fact, if you go and look at like, I can look at my phone really quick because I have the name. I'm bad at memorizing these things.
One of the things I'm worst at is coming up with lists of names or dates or titles.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm not like a walking bibliography.
No.
So I just have to go. And I'm glad this isn't live, because then I can just get up my phone and be like, okay, let's open the latest thing. Like, I'm reading right now if my Kindle will open. Yeah. Bam. The secret tantras of the fish wheel and the nine spaces, which is translated by Christopher Wilkinson. And then there's like the secret kissing of the sun and moon, and then the pearl necklace tantra. But the main book that he put all together is the eight early tantras of the great perfection. And so like the little books, the little titles are from the great perfection. And yeah, I guess like some of these titles, it's really funny because I'm just like, these books are so not sexual. Nothing in this is sexual. Like if you read this, these are like mystic poems about like consciousness and moving your energy around and like understanding like non-duality and all this stuff. But then the titles are like really beautiful. And then I was telling my friend, this is the pearl necklace tantra. This is the pearl necklace tantra. And then I was like, because I'm literally not thinking like pearl necklace tantra.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not thinking that. They're like, it's kind of like a sexual innuendo. And I'm like, see, no, it's not. I read like the half of this aloud to you. And, you know, and it's not. Did that say anything about like the other meaning of that term? It's talking about pearls as a precious adornment. And then this is like each verse is a pearl.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a rosary bead or like the Buddhist, you know, the beads that you wrap. So, but the great perfection kind of is another way. There are all these like secret tantras, these secret ways of coming into holiness, these like ancient texts. And like, I take a lot of inspiration from that sort of writing for my poetry, and I always have, being from like a religious background. My family is very religious. Like I was raised like very strictly, very religiously.
Mm-hmm.
In which faith?
Christian, like very Christian. Baptist. We have my family has our own church. My pawpaw is a minister.
Oh,
my dad's side. That's a family church. It's very small. It's like family and cousins, and we would go there on some holidays. And then my family then during like on non-holidays, because I grew up in the suburbs of Dallas, we would go to like mega churches.
Oh gosh, really?
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, I've always wondered, yeah, what was your experience like going to one of those?
It was not just one, because you never just go to just one mega. I mean, some people are like, you know, they go to just one mega church, but generally it's kind of like you go to different ones because it's kind of,
oh,
like,
I didn't know that parks.
It's
because it's like an amusement park. You don't want to just go to one. Or
yeah, kind of like, yeah, is it's that... kind of like there was one that was built near my high school, and we nicknamed it Six Flags Over Jesus.
Because
they would have like mega churches that are near high schools will hold like in their youth centers, which will be bigger than this building.
Gosh.
Like they'll have free pizza for all the high schoolers, and they'll like time it to like when you have off campus lunch in the area, and then, you know, you going for lunch and it's like there's free pizza over at Six Flags Over Jesus, let's go. And then you just don't listen, like they try, they like will play Jesus things in the back, and they like kind of, they know to not bother you too much, but they do,
but
kind of
it seeps in again,
and then
like
yeah it's really insidious because there's always that one person who's eating the pizza who's like, what's going on here,
right?
You know, like there's free pizza all the time. Oh yeah, brother, you can come every time.
And
we get on Wednesday night we have our meeting, and yeah, we have free pizza. And people are like, oh, and these people want to be my friend. And, you know, it's very insidious.
It's welcoming, right?
It's welcoming, but it's like, I mean, nobody. Like, mega churches are just so, it's like this massive anonymous warehouses of Jesus, you know?
anonymous warehouses of Jesus.
And also of money, because a lot of mega churches are, it's like, it's not, they have enormous resources, but they do not, they don't do like these direct action things, these like nonprofit type things. And they're nonprofits, but they ought to function. Well,
they're big nonprofits.
Yeah, they're big nonprofits. They're like the biggest nonprofits, but they don't give in the same way. And it's like they have to keep this edifice, you mm-hmm. know? And it, and that, I don't know, being raised in that, I just have a lot of like sadness around it, because I can see that like there's a lot of human potential energy for the collective that gets diverted into those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
They're like warehouses that siphon off what could, you know, save certain, you know, ways of living that are now going to have to be destroyed, because people, instead of using it to like develop new ways of being, buried them all there.
Right.
And so it was not good. And I don't.
Do you have siblings?
Oh, I have an older brother. Older. Or not older brother, I have a younger brother. I'm sorry.
A younger brother.
He is a lawyer.
Okay.
He is a lawyer in Waco. He is a prosecutorial lawyer for the DA.
Okay.
In Waco, which is very brave for a young black man in his late 20s to be.
Yeah.
Is he one of the few black guys in that department?
I think he's the only one.
The only one.
Wow. I think he might be the only one. He's probably the only one.
Yeah.
It's Waco.
Yeah. do you talk to him about that?
I love my brother. Yeah. My brother, like, he'll probably find this. He'll listen to this if I talk about him. I love my brother a lot. He, it's interesting because I'm pretty radicalized around my stuff. And I think in Texas, it's like everyone is pretty, you know, black people are radicalized. You're radicalized because you have to survive. It's very dangerous.
In Texas.
Yeah. Well, everywhere, you know, there's anti-blackness. And even in here, it's really violent and scary, you know.
Yeah.
But Texas is also, like, it's normalized. Like, the woman, the cop who was dating that dude and then rolled up in his house and, like, shot him.
Right.
And then it's all like, I couldn't see. I don't know what was happening. And I'm just like, see, no. It's really apparent from outside of Texas that this woman, that was, like, a crime of passion or whatever. But in Texas, they're like, oh, no. Because, Everyone has guns. Like, I am not afraid of guns because I've seen them. I've, like, dated people where, like, you don't reach under people's beds because, like, that's where guns are. And I've pulled out guns from other people's beds. I've been, like, playful with guns around people. Like, people have been playful with guns around me growing up. Like, one boy took us to his house, like, in a group to show all, like, his friends, all his female friends, his new gun, his new Glock.
And when you were in high school?
Yeah,
when
but that was pretty common. Like, it was like when somebody turned like 16, you get a car, you get like a Glock, or like if they're like a hunting family, you get like a big old gun. Yes. And they probably already had like lots of guns if they were a hunting family. You know, it's just like there's lots of guns. And I know how to shoot. And like, you know, I don't mind shooting. Like, I like shooting. Like, I've wanted to go shooting here like in Oregon. And that's like really scares people when I talk about that. And I'm just like, no, do you understand? Like, guns are not scary. People who are scary guns are scary.
Yeah,
it's just like weapons. I mean, like, if we want to talk about weapons exist. Anything can kill. Guns kill quickly. So does poison. So does, like, you know, like the fear is like, should we be afraid of poison rings? You know, somebody might have some strychnine for you. Things like that. I think everyone should be able to, like, defend themselves. I think it's like a form of like piousness in the Pacific Northwest. People are like, I have never been in a fight and I've never touched a gun. And I'm like, I don't trust you at all.
There's like, a lot of piousness, like pacifism.
But because it's not pacifism, because people can be really violent without having ever had laid a hand or picked up a gun. So I'm like, that means absolutely nothing that you haven't done those things. It just means that you have other ways of committing your violence, right?
Well, I mean, those ways can be not as direct, but sometimes more hurtful.
I know, like, you would rather somebody have shot you. That's some of the things that people do up here. Like, you would rather them just put a gun on the table and be like, let's settle this now. Like, you know, than like these kind of like, you know, silent wars or whatever.
So in high school, is that when you started writing seriously? Or when did the writing start? And then when did the music start? I mean, because Is Tabernacle your first, is that your first project or no?
It's my first EP.
Well, yeah.
So. It's my first EP. I'm going to release another EP probably by the end of this week.
And then the LP,
the LP, the big album, is coming out the same day as my book release on the 20th.
Oh.
Which they're all kind of hanging out, and I'm putting the finishing touches and being really shy. Is basically what's happening.
But the 20th of October?
20th this month.
Oh.
Next week.
So you have a big month.
Yeah, this month is pretty crazy. It's pretty wild.
Go on.
Oh, I mean, next week, which is my birthday on the 20th, too. So next week is my birthday.
Gosh.
And my book releases there at Mississippi Records.
Cool.
Or not at Mississippi Records. You have to X it out. I didn't say that. It's like they run Polaris, which is known as the North Star Ballroom, but I think it's Polaris Hall as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my book release is going to be. And I'm going to be playing with Sage Fisher, who plays under Dolphin Midwives.
Okay.
So I'm going to do music, and then Dolphin Midwives is going to play some stuff. It's going to be really nice.
What's your setup for performing? Because it's ambient music. How do you perform it?
Oh, can I answer the question about how I started? And then I want to answer that, too.
Of course.
Is that cool?
Of course.
For sure. So I started, I don't remember when I started writing poems the same way I don't remember when I learned how to read. Like, my parents say that I learned how to read when I was, like, under 3.
Gosh.
Because I used to be reading billboards and stuff. I don't remember ever not being able to read. I'm actually not good at teaching. Like, when I do teach, I teach, like, poetry, or I teach, like, critique, or how to, like, read text and the parse text, but I'm not good at teaching people how to recognize language.
Because it's so ingrained in you.
Yeah, because I don't remember learning how to read at all, or not being able to read, and I think that it's important when you teach to have, like, a memory of being in the place where somebody was mm-hmm. at. If you don't, you're just like, well, I don't know what's going on with you. That's kind of what happens. I started writing poetry when I was about 4, and my dad has some of the poems. I don't remember writing these poems very much. I do remember that I was pretty, I was kind of a loner. I was made fun of really intensely from a very young age. I was raised in a really white suburb of Dallas that was really, really racist, like racist enough that, like, people wouldn't let me come in their houses and play with their kids. Like, the kids would be playing with me outside, or they would take me to the house after school, and then they would try and let me, they'd be like, hey, come on in. And then I would maybe get into the foyer, and then their parents would see me, and they'd be like, come here, Shannon. And then, like, wow. You know, and then I'd just be standing in the foyer, and then like, maybe like a sibling or their parent would scowl at me, and then, like, they'd be like, they'd let me outside, and they'd be like, you know, my mom and dad said you can't be in the house.
How old were you?
I was like, up until I was like 5, 6, 7.
Oh,
that was
God.
Like part of being in the neighborhood that we were at. God. And so, you know, and it was also, you know, people don't necessarily let you, like, that was my impression. Like, this is why we don't, you know, you're not supposed to go try and go to white people's houses because there's a chance it would happen. And then there was like some white people who were our friends who would come over to my house, or who would, like, let us in, but it's like you had to mark them out. And then there was Jewish people who lived across the street from us, and they were okay with us as well because people weren't into Jewish people either, so like so it was like that. So I was pretty isolated and kind of not really social, and I read constantly, and I think I started reading, like, little haikus or something, because the poems I wrote when I was 4 are, like, these really sad little haikus about, like, rain
and
clouds and, like, things dying, but they're, like, 4 lines, 3 and 4 lines.
What did your parents do? I mean, there were books in the house, or were they were encouraging, I guess, or what?
My parents, both my mom is a master's degree and is a pharmacist.
Okay.
And then my father has a master's degree in business and has always worked in, like, banking or for, like, government, like, been a civil servant, like, government money stuff. And then my mom was doing pharmacy stuff, being a pharmacist for a long time, and then she stopped to be, like, a homemaker. My mom is very religious, and so she was at home.
Right.
A lot of times, sometimes working, not. There was a lot of books in our house. I was also, like, you know, privileged enough in this kind of tangential way, like, you know, with parents being very rare among their generation. to have like that kind of like wherewithal to be able to just, you know, I was able to get whatever books I liked. My dad,
so
I was like able to go, we would go to bookstores all the time. That's like how I bonded with, you know, my father, is just we go to bookstores, or he would leave me there. It was one of the only places I was really allowed to like be besides like church or home, or like people who like they, it was like a bookstore or a library.
Mm-hmm.
So I get lived there.
It was a safe space to a certain degree.
Yeah, I was just like, you know, I could read whatever I wanted. And so, yeah, I was just reading everything in the house. We had lots of like liturgical texts, like a lot of religious texts, because, you know, my family was super, super religious. Mm-hmm. and learned about it, like wanting to read like every single like epistle from like all these different versions. And so there's all these like religious texts, and there's also my parents' books. And then the Bible, like constantly looking at the Bible. So there's like the cadence of that that gets into your head. And I think that aside from the indoctrinatory like elements of like reading a lot of liturgical or spiritual texts, like I think it's important for the development of your writing, your poetic, especially if you're a poet, like your writing practice, to at least engage that.
It, with the Holy Bible?
Not with the Bible, but I mean, with spiritual texts, like with like mystery texts, with like the verses of some tradition of mm-hmm. spiritual practice. And there's, you know, there's thousands of those. There's something that is ancient, that has rhythm, that is trying to speak to something bigger than you.
Hmm.
And then that is also inherently in you, which is like the great mystery of a lot of, you know, religious stuff, is that like this God actually isn't outside.
Right.
You know? So I think that that's like really important. I think that even if people weren't raised with that, I think it's important to engage with it, because it's not, you don't, you're, especially if you weren't raised with it, you're definitely not, you're definitely not going to become indoctrinated by reading it. I mean, if it lights you up, maybe, but it's, what it's probably going to do is repattern you.
So it's important as literature, not necessarily as a spiritual thing. So I mean,
I feel like literature is spiritual.
Uh-huh.
Like I don't. I think that all things are spiritual. Like I say, like there's like energy that moves all things, and all things that live are alive, right? And it's just different frequencies of consciousness. And so we're tuned to one set of frequencies. The trees are on another. They have heartbeats. They do things. Like bugs are on another. Dirt is on another. Soil is on another. Concrete, being the amalgamation of other living things, is on another frequency. There's nothing that is dead in this world.
And it's all part of a harmony, kind of.
Yeah, and it's all singing. So I feel like literature, you know, that's also why you have to like kind of watch your intake with literature, because actually this is all spiritual. This is all going to have an effect on you. It's all going to write onto you. You know, so you have to be careful what you take in and what you're willing to be written upon. And it's important to be conscious of how you're being written upon. And I think like a lot of poetry that I like, that I appreciate, comes from like that kind of space between like understanding everything is alive and then watching it write on you.
Right.
And being conscious in that process.
Okay. So being aware. Yeah.
Yeah. Being aware at these like very steel levels. But that's, yeah, I guess this is where my poetry practice like comes from, starts when I was very little, and then I just was writing from there. And then, you know, in high school I started like a poetry circle, which is really funny. It's like the first little workshop I ever had. It was like me and like about like 10-15 other people, and
big
made posters.
Yeah.
And did it get to 15? Oh, 10 might have been the biggest it ever got to. Maybe it was 10 folks. It was just the folks, like four friends and a couple other people. And then I made posters for it, and like we would come and share our poetry. I did like workshops, of course, in college. I feel like I've never had a workshop that ever taught me anything, but I've had relationships with like older poets that have taught me things.
Right.
I'm not somebody that learns well in a group. I do not like group work.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like it. It's just,
well, because I'm kind of the same way. I've taken a lot of poetry workshops, and I've found them not very helpful, because sometimes what one person really likes, the person next to that person really hates. So you never really know. And then B, consensus is hard when you're dealing with something.
It's impossible. But I don't even like, because consensus is a possible thing if people have all like processed their stuff. But like in a poetry workshop, like like, I'm always clear about being like, okay, y'all, like, I'm always like clear about being like, this is not, and this is like harsh, but it's like, I'm like, this is not therapy.
This is
not a therapy like session, because there's a consent issue there. Because, okay, so you're going to be dealing with powerful and intense subject matter. You can write about anything in that space. But what you cannot request from everyone is them that they be emotionally present in such a way to help you process, like, your feelings on, like, trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some workshop spaces, and there's some, you know, communities that, like, write poetry where that is what that is for them, and that is what it is, and that is how it's functioning. And I think that's really, that's perfect, because that's that. But I don't think that that is all that poetry is. You know, I think it's, like, rather reactionary to kind of want, to even want that, to kind of have all poetry be, like, hyper-legible,
right,
like, retellings of, like, trauma that then everyone kind of, like, validates you for expressing. Like, that is a part of, like, what poetry can be, but it isn't, you know, it isn't the only thing.
It's just one spot in the continuum.
Yeah, and in this vast space, you know, right. It's like I take comfort in the infinity of how infinite poetry can be.
Mm-hmm.
I get kind of sad when people are like, I don't write, I can't write anymore. And I'm like, but it's everywhere. Like, it's everywhere. You maybe can't do what you were doing, but you can do something else. And maybe that's what's being told to you, is that, like, the way you're thinking about it is different, needs to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, workshops, yeah, I've done workshops, and every time I do a workshop, it is always just saying, like, this is like an unworkshop. This is like, mm-hmm. this is not this other kind of space. I think a lot of people seem to come to poetry looking, I mean, they come to all of the art you're looking, if you're a maker, I try not to use the term creatives, because I think that it's very capitalist and, like, fascist and corny. But, like, I say, like, makers, because it's, like, hands-on element, but also, like, you know, just straight up, like, you write poems. But a lot of people come to it, and they're, like, they want someone to tell them that they're smart, and they think that, like, writing poetry is, like, the way to show people that you, like, are a deep thinker and, like, you're smart. And I'm like, I don't know. You're asking a lot of poetry at this point. You're asking poetry to carry your ego,
mm-hmm.
and your sense of self into the room. And then you're asking poetry to then seduce, like, everyone into the room into telling you what you need to hear, or to, like, upholding, like, your kind of, like, systemic construction of who you ought to be recognized for these particular verse. And I just never make these kind of demands on my writing or my art or anything. Like,
sure.
I'm very much always fighting to have more space to just do stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always just about taking more space to do and make and find new ways and expand continuously in the making and in the process and to learn more. Like, I don't think I will ever be at a point where I'm, like, done with developing how I write or, like, how I process writing or how I make art or how I make music. Like, I will never be done. I will always be learning new things. There will always be new things to show. And that's, like, amazing.
Right. You know? Well, kind of touching on that, I guess. So you took workshops, from a young age, poetry was something that was important to you that you kind of took into your future. And then what about music? When did you start? Was that the same thing? Were they
music is kind of, is a little different for me. Like, I've always loved music. Like, obviously, like, if you grew up in church, there's, like, you're around music and you hear music. And, like, I've always had, like, an ambivalent relationship to singing and to my voice and to making music. I took violin for a long time,
mm-hmm.
in school. I play violin sometimes. I haven't done that in a long time in any of my live sets or anything, but I do have one. This electric thing that you can plug in. I might start doing that again probably soon. Dig it out. And I kind of felt like, you know, the engagements with music from, like, that sort of, like, Suzuki method, like, professionalized stuff was super, super traumatic and not cool.
What's the Suzuki method for people like me who don't know?
It's like this is the way that they kind of teach you how to play, like, string instruments or just, I think, like, any instruments, like, from the beginning. It's like, it's just, like, sometimes some people get that in private lessons, like, before they start, like, whatever school level that your school district starts, like, orchestra or band or whatever. And then usually, at least in my experience when I was in school, and I know that my daughter's school kind of does this, it's like you have private lessons and you have the main band, especially if you didn't have them before, just to get you on point and to keep you on point. Mm-hmm. And the Suzuki method is like this, like book, these booklets, this way of like teaching people how to play music, and how to like hold things and how to just comport yourself and be like playing music. And
so very structured, organized.
Yeah, it's like
so
super, super just
almost like a PowerPoint for young musicians.
Yes. Yeah, this is the Suzuki method. And it's kind of like a philosophy of like how music is. And,
Which you find challenging as someone who doesn't learn that way.
Yeah, I found it really challenging. And I was kind of embedded with like people who were like in show choir and like who are like, you know, this kind of in theater folk. And I'm like, I'm not that, like, I'm not theatrical and I'm not like, you know, I'm not a show choir person. I do sing. And so, for me, like, and of course, like I had like my forays into like playing the guitar, like I can play guitar and like, you know, I wanted people to make like little bands, like into like,
and this is in high school?
Like not in high school. Like I was fooling around with all that stuff, like in college. Mm-hmm. I learned guitar in college.
Which is University of North Texas.
Well, I went there, and the first school I went to was in Louisiana. I went to Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, okay. In the Honors College there, and that's where I learned to play guitar.
Oh.
So there, and that was also kind of where I would think about singing, and I started kind of thinking about, like, well, what could I do with music, and, like, what kind of music am I listening to that is more open to where I'm going. I was like a really like goth, like punk, like banger, like person in high school. Like I wore like bracelets up to my elbow and I had like my hair straightened and kind of like cut over here.
And did you listen to that music too or what?
Yeah, I listened to like a lot of like hardcore music and like a lot of like kind of baby gothy stuff.
Baby
gothy stuff. And then as I got a little older, that's when the Cateau twins, like, appeared in my life. It was, like, right around when I was, like, I was 17 when I went to college. So it was, like, in that first year when I turned 18 that I was like, oh, the Cateau twins, what is this? This is everything I've wanted.
And how would you describe them to somebody who doesn't know, like...
The Cateau twins?
Yeah.
Like,
UK.
Like I'm like glossolalia. Like, that's the term. But, they have lyrics. They have songs, but they are extremely abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It's sound based and resonance based, kind of shoegazy dream pop that is a little ominous and at times creepy and psychedelic. And you think that it's going to be a song that's going to have a chorus, and you're like, "Is this a chorus? I just love her voice. What's happening?" You know, it's very like beautiful experience. And I like Cranes too. Was really important.
Cranes, that's a band?
Yeah, it's been the Cranes. It's
the
this,
Cranes.
It's like I think it's like a early mid, maybe still active. I'm not sure. Like kind of shoegazy, dream poppy, sort of gothy music, and the girl has like a very baby thingy voice, like she sings like a baby, but the sounds are really heavy and sometimes industrial. So I started listening to stuff like that,
and you latched onto it because it's sound based more than kind of lyric based, or just why'd you gravitate towards Cateau twins and Cranes?
Cateau twins. Yeah,
are they French or British?
They're British. They're okay. Scottish.
Okay.
Yeah, they're Scots folk. I kind of drifted to it, yeah, because it wasn't making demands, it was making different demands on me than like, you know, narrative structure music. And I mean, of course, like, yeah, I love Brian Eno, and then I love like Laraji and things like that. And those are all things that kind of appeared during college. Me finding out about that kind of music.
And Laraji is the one I don't know anything about. I know nothing.
Oh, Laraji.
Laraji.
So Laraji is this awesome mystic. He is a black man who was a comedian from the stories. And then in the 70s, this is a long time ago. This is one story I've read. It might be wrong. He was a comedian and he was playing on street corners. And then he had like a conversion into, I think he has like a, it's Buddhism or Hinduism. He has like a spiritual practice that he is embedded in. And he was living on the street or playing on the street, maybe not living on the street. And then Brian Eno walked by like in the mid-70s and was like, hell yes, what is this? And they were like, hey. And then he recorded a bunch of albums with Brian Eno in the early 80s.
Okay.
Also, like, believes in this, like, kind of laughter as, like, spiritual and therapeutic. So there's all these, like, kind of new agey, like, tracks of, like, him just, like, laughing and chanting and, like, all these sounds. And he's just, over the years, like, played with all these, like, amazing experimental, like, sound musicians and is still living.
Yeah, he's still active, I was going to say.
Yeah, he just had a couple albums come out in the past year or so.
Oh.
And so, and it's just very inspiring music. It's, like, they also pick up, like, elements of gospel and elements of, like, other, like, spiritual traditions, like, in their music. Lotus Collage from the 70s, their music from the late 70s, there's, like, a compilation of them that's, like, some of my favorite stuff. It's really inspiring. Lotus Collage, and then Unicorns in Paradise, which is, like, an 11-minute song that's really gorgeous. And I listen to it when I, like, in studio and I make art and stuff. I like to play Laraji because it's, like, big, long stuff. And he kind of goes in and out of, like, kind of different emotional states, bells, different sounds. And then he, like, kind of will end sometimes with just, like, all praises be to the oneness and the one power. And he goes into, like, a chant. And then he's, like, all thanks and blessings, gives thanks, gives gratitude, and then, like, the thing is over. And I think that that's, like, a really powerful kind of ritualistic engagement with sound and music that that, like, informs my practice around that.
So that's one of the things I was going to ask. So you listen to music while you're making your own kind of, I guess, writing, not your own music, but...
I mean, when I listen to music, I make, like my digital art, or when I make, because I do sculpture too, and I do, like, installations and stuff like that. Like, if I'm building something, or if I'm painting, or if I'm, like, doing digital artwork, like, on my computer, like, I'm always listening to music. I listen to Alice Coltrane a lot. A lot of people don't know about how Alice Coltrane has their own spiritual retreat, and they had a spiritual conversion, especially after the death of, you know, their partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, like, albums called, like, the holy music of, like, Alice Coltrane, and it's really fascinating if you go listen to, like, her whole discography, to watch her kind of transition into, like, this, and to bring with all these elements of gospel, of all the other kinds of music she's learned, all the, like, 70s rock. There's albums she made with, like, Carlos Santana, where he's going by his, like, spiritual name. Like, you know, this is, like, all this really amazing stuff. And then the progression, you know, up until, like, up right until she was, like, you know, no longer living. It's just amazing. You don't really see, like, black, you don't really... That's kind of like a hidden history of, like, black artists that's not, like, mainstreamed or, like, put out there, that, like, this is possible, that you can go from making, like, this super legible classical, like, stylistic, like, music into, like, something that is combining elements of that into, like, your spirituality, and, you know, and then this is, like, you expressing, like, your spiritual self that isn't just, like, it is like, has gospel embedded in it, but it is not gospel. It is literally, like, the gospel of you finding, like, source.
Right.
And I love Alice Coltrane because of that. Like, all of her chanting, like, everything she does is, like, one of my favorite.
And you discovered her in college, or when?
Yeah, like, I started, like, finding out about her in college. And what's funny is that, like, none of this music was very cool to the people that I knew, like, at the time in college.
They weren't, so you were, okay.
I was not really talking. It's, like, a lot of stuff, it's, like, I wasn't really talking about, there wasn't really space for me to be, like into that sort of stuff when I was in school.
At LSU and North Texas?
Yeah, there wasn't really space for me to be into that. I mean, because I have, like, you know, for better or for worse, like, I have so much music that I have listened to that I don't listen to anymore, but I have, like, lots of song memorized, like, in Texas a lot. Like, I listen to a lot of stuff like Jason Molina in Slums, oh, Ohio.
We were just talking with another person, Justin Taylor, about him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jason Molina is, like, you know, may he like, rest forever.
Uh-huh.
It was, like, you know, voice so holy, voice so beautiful, and Slums, Ohio was, like, really important. I was listening to that a lot.
Right.
Because that was, like, the kind of people I was around, and, like, Nick Cave and
Nick
Tom
Cave.
Waits.
Uh-huh.
And, like the best concert I've ever been to, or the most interesting one that I remember is, like, I saw Tom Waits in Prague.
Waits in Prague.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And I think
is this college or post-college?
This is post-college. Okay. This was, like, about, like, 7-8 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I was there, and his son was doing, because his son travels with him sometimes and plays, his son was there playing with him. And that was pretty intense and amazing. But it's funny, because I don't really listen to that anymore. But it's like, so it's also in the cave too as well. Like, it, but that sort of aesthetic is like foundational in some ways, like in the back of my brain.
Right. It's part of you now, even if you don't listen to it all the, sure.
Or like sometimes I'm just like, I have to play like, you know, this like whole Songs of Ohio album. Like I have to play like Ghost Transmission. Like I have to play this now. Or I have to play, my favorite album in them is
Axis and Ace.
No, it's, the one that has, let's see.
We were just talking about
East Hearts Divided on it.
And
Impala.
The Lioness and something? No.
No, not the Lioness. It's, oh, what's, because we're not live. I can look it up. Because I want to know it. Because I love that album, and it's the one that's my favorite one. And I was like, considering covering it or singing it, because I just get obsessed with that. And Division Street Girl is also like one of my favorite songs by him. That's off, actually from his, Pyramid Electric Company stuff.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so I was like into all that stuff, which I think is like kind of, it's not standard. Like I found out that's not actually standard when you come up here. That's like a very like little, when I moved up here, there was like types of music that like I thought were like, this is like this kind of rock. But then up here, it's like, this is like Southern bluesy twangy stuff.
In Portland, it's just different.
It was arranged differently, and I thought that was so interesting when I moved here, because I was like, it is kind of weird.
Right.
Like, I love Black Heart Procession. That was actually, when I was in school in Louisiana, I went to New Orleans to go see them. It was the first time I was in New Orleans and the first show I ever saw there.
Mm-hmm.
And Black Heart Procession is not like really, like, people associate that with like the kind of southernness thing, and I see them as being like super loungy and like
right. Film
noir and sophisticated kind sure. of music.
But the music doesn't change. It's just the distinctions around it. But it's completely just, like, different.
People have like this other headspace, and so
regionality.
You'll also see like there's different people at like different shows.
Totally.
Where you're just like, oh, these people come to this. This is so interesting.
And so this, I mean, this month, I guess, though, is kind of a huge culmination for you in a lot of ways, right? I mean, your first LP, I mean, this first book coming out, or does this seem like you've been working towards this? Or, I mean, it's all just kind of its own thing.
It's like such a bit. I mean, September is like always my birthday month.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always like a month of reckoning for me.
Oh.
How
are you defining reckoning?
Like, where it's just like, well, where am I at? Like, what's going on in the past year? It's like my solar return. And so I kind of have been floating through this month like this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. Just tracing myself along, trying to figure out like, well, this is the culmination of a lot, but I also have a lot of other things now that this is happening. And able to look back and be like, you know, like 5 years ago, I had started to want certain things. And now they are here. And they're definitely here, and they're mine, and they're actually here. But now there's all these other things that are going to happen. And so it's like exciting, because it's like, well, 5 years from now.
Well, what? So let's break it down. 5 years ago, what got in your head? What were some of the things that are now here?
Well, my book is here, and like,
did you start writing this 5 years ago?
I wrote that like, it came together really quickly. It's like fragments of things.
Uh-huh.
I always write in fragments. That's another thing. Like, I don't write by fiat. Like, I don't go like, I'm coming in here to write a poem. This is going to be my book. That's like not the things I demand of my writing either. But like when there's enough stuff that's happened, mm-hmm. and it starts to resonate, I'm like, how can this be? How does it resonate? And so I had like lots of fragments floating, and I was talking to Mike Young, who is my editor and amazing person at Magic Helicopter Press. Woo, Mike. Mike is awesome. We love Mike. And I just started sending them some fragments, and they were like, send me more. Let's more fragments, more. More.
This is how
last
long ago?
Year.
Last year.
Last year. And like actually late last year. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, is this enough fragments? And can it have my paintings, because I've been making these drawings.
Which are part of the book. They're in the book.
Yeah. And they were like, and I was kind of shocked because they were like, yeah. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. And then that's how I have like a lovely little kind of art book, poetry book.
Sure.
That happened that I can show two people. The music piece, five
and they
ago,
can read it, too.
And they
can
read
show,
it,
can show
and they can look, these yeah. is your art, and these are poems uh-huh. that you wrote, or form things, language that you've got going in this book.
How do you say the title?
Quere.
Quere.
Yeah.
Okay. And why yeah. how, why that title?
That is from this article. I was reading this article, interview with Jarrett Sexton, who is a scholar of Black studies. Uh-huh. The article is called On Black Negativity or the Affirmation of Nothing, and it's on the Society and Space website. And it actually came out like around this time last year. So I read that article. I got it open here. And
maybe we can link to it on our website.
Yeah, and then the word quere came up talking about... I guess I can read, because I wanted to maybe read some of the things that was in this article. I was looking at it, that explains kind of like how Jarrett Sexton constructs blackness, because that's a lot of how I do too.
How he what?
Constructs blackness. Constructs blackness. It's like the sociopolitical status of blackness in the modern world. If blackness opens the space for articulating what is unthought, this is because blackness is that which relates to the undoing or unraveling of every social bond, and so inhabits them negatively from within. And that's from this article, and that's kind of, you know, that's how I think about blackness and how I am engaged with my blackness. And
okay.
Quere is like this gesture, basically. It's like,
describe the ask, gesture that you do
to ask. Yeah, that's funny. I was like this gesture, yeah. Television audience. It's like to reach, to ask, to desire, and the constant like to exist outside of the modern construction of the human. I'm going from Alexander Wahili and who else, like I'm going from a lot of like theory on like anti-blackness and Afro-pessimism and things like that, where you're talking about like the construction of blackness as being outside of the human. There's like controversy around the construction of blackness that Afro-pessimism uses, where it's considered to be like U.S. saying like U.S. black centric, because the term black is not African diasporic and talking about like everyone who is spread from the African continent throughout the world. But I kind of feel that. And also the construction of blackness as being a category, like dark-skinnedness, like having like the skin color, like stuff is like a product of colonization and slavery and the Enlightenment construction of the Union. So it's inherently bound in time. So like while people have like these critiques of anti-blackness of being like exclusive to like an American construction, I think really it's just kind of time constricted rather than place constricted, in that like mm-hmm. prior to the Enlightenment, when they were trying to come up with a justification for why they needed like slavery, like chattel slavery, and also like how do we mark those who will serve like the beginning engines of capitalism,
sure.
This is where like blackness became constructed as like a form of otherness that like goes down and down and down and is passed intergenerationally and that sort of thing. And so
and this finds its way into your book in indirect ways.
In that, like, I am, you know, African diasporic, and, like, I am writing this book, and I am black, and I, because I'm black, and I write this book. So, I don't necessarily, like, I'm not didactic.
Right, sure,
I do,
sure.
There's, like, you know, there's things that would kind of, like, reference that. It floats around it.
But it's part of who you are, so it's not something that, yeah.
It's separate, but I don't think I have to speak directly on it or have it be, you know, if I want to write an essay on the thing, I will write an essay on the thing, but
right.
I have the poems, and the poems are, they do what they do. I don't make those kinds of demands on them to be
sure.
identifying me. But it's going to, but like the idea of this, like being outside of the human, and so what your desire is unknowable, and it is also interpolated with all these not yous, with all which you are really aware of what you are not, and how you are not that, and also how those who are not like constructed thus cannot quite ever conceive you, they would have to lose themselves because they are made of these frames that were made to exclude you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what like Quere is kind of like dealing with, that like pressure and tension and desire and kind of like, what is the fantasy life? What is the fantasy life inside of that sort of like liminal space, that liminality that occurs?
Right.
And then it's from like very much from myself, from like a Black queer femme like perspective where, but I feel like it is that because I am that and this is in my writing, but I don't make demands on my writing to educate or to inform people about these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there, and I'm much more interested in people hearing that that's a part of my writing, going and looking into like Jared Sexton and reading like that article and that interview and like engaging with the ideas therein and seeing where that takes them, rather than, you know, reading my poem and feel like that changed me and like now I'm sure. Like this, and I'm like, I don't know how that could do that for you, but that's okay.
But it's a starting point rather yeah. than an end point.
Yeah, it's this kind of like, this might be a doorway for you, or it might be just a doorway for you into some sounds you haven't heard, you know, some poetry you haven't thought of. I'm not so it's like, this is not to mean that I'm not like extremely like radicalized and like have like very like concrete sort of like structures, and I am like a Virgo. I'm just like being really chill right now. So like I just, you know, but I also don't like it. I feel really trapped when people are like, your poems haven't like been didactic enough on the topics of your marginalization. Can you please like, you know, make it more thus? Because there's nothing wrong with that. Because I think for some people, like that is how they write, and then it's just direct. Because again, it's like also where you're at where you're writing, which is just like you write to be understood in this particular way,
right.
And that's perfect. That is perfect in itself. But I'm not necessarily writing to be seen or understood in a particular way. Like, I don't think that my poetry book or my poetry is my face.
Right.
You know, or it's not. And so if you don't understand my poems, I almost don't care. I want you to understand yourself better. It's about a process of it's about you processing these words and these images and with my music and these sounds. If you don't understand it, maybe it sends you on a journey to where you reach your own kind of understanding of what you're seeking, as opposed to like a lesson from me.
That kind of seems like a perfect note for you to read something. Would you like to?
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Yes.
All right, you got it.
I can do that.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to have a sip.
Yeah.
Let's see. I will pick a thing. Let's see. I'm also, I was like, I want to thank Mike Young again, because Mike did all of this awesome layout. Mike is awesome. So if you go get my book, look at the book, think of how pretty it is, and thank Mike Young in your
Thank
bed.
You, Mike.
Thank it you, is Mike. Really pretty to hold.
I know. It's awesome. Let's see. What's the part that I don't usually read? Oh, I'm going to read this part here. Melt that ice where it would not flow. Learn that water you are have got to get out to sea. You have to know that not only is water whole, it is particulate. That the sea opens into the ocean and it will scour away everything that you held the ice in your mouth with. Will destroy the memory of your mouth. Will take your body. That the ocean is where things begin and end. And that where water is, there is catastrophe, there is undoing. This is how nothing dies or ends. This is where you cannot help but begin. With ice in your mouth, seeking the outside of your body. That water will end you and everything you, and is no more than you. That your body is ice that would not flow, but now seeks. That your mouth is not yours or your body. That the ocean will stay outside of you only to become you. It makes your mouth as you hold it. That your mouth is the poison circling in and out of the water as much as it is the ocean it devours. That you are trash into sand, into flesh, into water, which is wet from being known and known, which is not your body, which is the ocean. And you want me to read some more?
No more? Let's do one more, yeah.
One more? Let's see. I said, I am new people and I am interested. I am brand new and I tell you what I said. I am here to be turned out from myself by your eyes. I tell you, I am undone by the gaze. I am on my back and I want what I said. I'm only starting here. What excuse can I give here being born? I am maybe what you will eventually say. As it stands, I have just left my mother under your care. I live in your mouth because you saw me. You let me in because you care only about what can be important. That is not necessary. You would have no use. You would keep clean hands until you were casket bound to the soil. The grass on your grave thrives in thrall to you. What I said, you would be a good man to bury, to hold to the ground. You would be grand cover, and I said, you will cover me. Now you don't want that kind of battle, up to the wall and then up it again, up and up until you can't possibly know how high, then my leg over your neck and arm down about your body face to face. Now we can talk, anything that you want. I can do or be you or anything. Okay.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Demondria.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming out.
Yes.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.